Christopher Moore is the author of the book called In Other Words. It's a dictionary of difficult and often untranslatable words. Steve Folson was intrigued and wanted to know more. For instance, in Arabic, there's no word for compromise.
Arabic has plenty of words for coming to agreement about different things, words like tawfiq, which means settlement, and sahwela, which means even-handedness. But there is no specific word for compromise in the sense that we use it, where it has, in our culture, a slightly negative implication. I had to compromise is the kind of the unspoken suggestion.
Right. I have to give up something, and you have to give up something as well, so that we can have a deal.
Yeah. Whereas in Arabic, we have this lovely word, taradin, which means to come to mutual consent about something where neither person feels robbed or cheated or has to, as we say, compromise on their principles or on something important.
Mm-hmm. Now, I was also taken by the German word Weltschmerz.
Yes, yes. Well, that goes along with a whole period and culture of sort of world weariness and that kind of European soul tragedy that affected so many cultures, the end of the 19th century, the early 20th century, a time of soul crisis, maybe, in Europe. And there are words in French as well, which come out of the period of Romanticism, like spleen. Spleen is a completely untranslatable word. It doesn't mean an organ of the body. It's used in French to mean this sort of dis-ease with the world, this tragic sense of life, if you like, and an inability to make sense out of life. Weltschmerz means world pain, so there's a similarity in the sense.
It does seem the Europeans almost have a corner on those words that suggest great angst in the world. And I'm also thinking of the Czech word, litosht.
Yes, that's a lovely word, which it is actually found in some other Slav languages, and in its proper sense it means mercy or compassion. But it was given a particular twist, ironic twist, by the Czech writer Milan Kundera in his Book of Laughter and Forgetting. And he kind of uses it, he perhaps redefines it in a way, to say that it's a state of torment induced by the sight of your own misery, which I think is a wonderful, wonderfully humorous description. But it's very complex, and he goes on. The definition he gives in the book is actually quite long and complex, and it has also elements of grief and a desire for revenge too, even, because you are not happy with yourself. You want to take it out on the world around you. So it's got an unpleasant side to it, potentially. But in that lovely sort of quip that I mentioned, that state of torment induced by the sight of your own misery, I think that's such a lovely phrase that had to have that in the book.
Right. Now, there are whole books that have been written about the Spanish word duende. How would you explain its meaning?
Well, have you got an hour and a half?
It seems to be something very desirable, because a lot of people talk about duende now and want to have more of it, but what exactly it is kind of mysterious.
Mm. Yes, it is. Now, I would say, and this is getting rather philosophical, duende is one of those things that the more you try and have it, the further you are away from it. Duende was described by Federico García Lorca, the Spanish poet of the 1930s, who died tragically in the Civil War. He described it in a beautiful essay, which is the best description that I know. It's a few pages long, but he talks about duende as that magical peak of artistic excitement where it just blows your mind.
Don't we tend to use that word, if we're talking about artists, for those people who have been, who've sort of led tortured lives, Billie Holiday,
yes,
or people like that?
Yes, that's very true. But duende itself is not to do with wrecking your own life. It's a momentary thing. It's a peak of experience. James Joyce uses the word epiphany, for example, in the artistic context. to have an epiphany is when you're writing a poem or a drama or whatever it is, and you suddenly, it's as if you suddenly rise through the clouds and you see, you have a vision of something. You may not be able to use words for it. Most Duende is beyond words, but it's an intensity of experience which is above the normal. And then you come down again. You can't hold it. That's why I say, if you try and go after it, you won't find it. It's always a kind of a byproduct of something else you're engaged in.
You say there's a word from Africa, from the Congo, that is supposedly the most untranslatable word in the whole world, Ilunga.
Yes, that's it's a word from the Shiluba language, which is spoken in the Congo. It's a word for a person who is ready to forgive an abuse for the first time, to tolerate it a second time, but never a third time. All in one word.
But I do like that meaning. I mean, I sort of wish there was an English equivalent.
Yeah. Well, yes. How do you get all that into one word?
Yeah. Right. Yeah. There was a Japanese word that I found intriguing, shibui, which is something about beauty, but that's not revealed right away.
Yes. Well, interesting thing about Japanese and Chinese, too, come to that, is they have some extraordinarily ancient words for aspects of aesthetics. And very, very refined, very, very hard for the Western mind really to appreciate. We all know the image of Japanese art with its close association with Zen and the idea of the summit of Japanese art being that the artist practices a million times in order to perform a gesture perfectly once. You know, so there is a whole life training that goes into something like calligraphy, for example, or pen painting. And so all this work goes into just producing that single moment where you, with one gesture of the hand or the wrist, you can produce a perfect expression of your art. And what they're trying to say in this word shibui is that probably that has to do with this longevity of practice and this longevity of refining oneself, that the person who is practicing the art acquires also a beauty. So there is a kind of virtue of resonance, of depth, of beauty that comes out of sheer experience and knowledge and understanding. But it can apply to anything that has this quality of ancientness as well. I think you'd probably have to be Japanese to understand it fully, but I've tried to give a description of it.
Now, we've been talking about how some words are just very difficult to translate into other languages, that you almost can't do it. And there's actually a Japanese phrase, yokomeshi, which gets at this quite explicitly, doesn't it?
Yes, yokomeshi is an interesting word. It's a play on words, a play on the phrase yokomoji, which means horizontal language. And yokomeshi is horizontal food, or horizontal meal. And I believe it may have originated with the particular difficulty that Japanese speakers had, who were obliged, perhaps for business purposes or international relations, to eat with foreigners, and therefore had to speak English or another foreign language in order to socialize. So this little play of words of horizontal eating emerged. But it has since broadened, I think, to mean any general difficulty of working with a foreign language. So it's the particular stress caused by trying to speak a foreign language. Horizontal eating, horizontal meal.
Christopher Moore is the author of the book called In Other Words, A Language Lover's Guide to the Most Intriguing Words Around the World. Steve Paulson spoke with him.